The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This hour, we're going to talk about healthcare in America once again, and talk about what happened with the public option being off the table. What do we mean? What do we mean by co-ops? Has President Obama lost the initiative now? Is the opposition taking sway, or are we still going to have some kind of healthcare reform? And what does it mean for all of us? But first, let me make sure you get home safe wherever it is you're going, and turn this over to WEAA Traffic and News, and we'll be right back.
Support for WEAA is provided by Luna, offering flooring, carpet, hardwood, and laminate flooring. Information at 877-241-LUNA or luna.com.
Northbound 95 between Moravia Road and White Marsh Boulevard. Slow traffic. Update brought to you by Caltrain. The issue, a disabled vehicle reported at the 895 merge. 95 southbound after White Marsh Boulevard, an accident blocking the shoulder. Inner loop of the Beltway heavy, Charles to Providence. Between 95 and Frederick Road, slow traffic with a stalled vehicle reported before Frederick Road as well on the west side. Baltimore City accident, Tilton Parkway at North Avenue. Cold Spring at Sedgwick and Charles at Lombard. Old Court at Liberty for an accident in Randallstown, one at Rosedale. Pulaski Highway at 64th Street, and in PG County, 95 southbound at 198. Word of a crash there as well. Get a little TLC every day. Tender loving Caltrate. Caltrate has essential daily calcium plus advanced levels of vitamin D to help you absorb that TLC. I'm Joanna Campbell with Baltimore Area Traffic.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're going to, as I said, talk about healthcare. It's been much in the news. Many people who have fought hard for comprehensive healthcare reform in America were taken aback by the message from the White House that the public option may be, in fact, off the table, and started talking about placing that with a $6 billion investment effort into co-ops. But many people in America aren't even sure what a co-op means. We know there's maybe three that work well in America, one in Wisconsin, one in Seattle, and one in Minnesota. Is that right? And one in Minnesota. They started in the 1930s when in Oklahoma, where I think they also still exist, where people who were out of work and farmers and workers and small business people pulled together to create a co-ops where doctors were salaried and healthcare was given to people. And that was, but does that answer the question? So this hour, we're going to talk to people, all of whom really do want to see serious healthcare reform in America, but very different ideas about how we should get there and what this present, perhaps, impasse means. We're joined in studio here by all three of our guests. Vinny DeMarco is with us once again. He's Executive Director of Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. Vinny, always good to see you.
Thank you.
Dr. Margaret Flowers is with us, who is co-chair and congressional fellow of the Maryland branch of Physicians and National Healthcare Program. Have that one right? Good. And Dr. Brad Herring is with us, who is assistant professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And Brad, welcome for the first time. Good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And the lines are open at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. What are your thoughts about healthcare and the reform package? Has President Barack Obama strategically blown it in terms of healthcare reform, or is about to go down the tubes? Is the public option critical to this healthcare reform? And where will it take us? It seems that what we've seen now is that part of the healthcare industry, part of the health insurance industry, has unleashed a barrage against healthcare reform. And what has been unleashed in America is kind of part of its underbelly of politics that has kind of taken over town hall meetings. And I say underbelly, it sounds pejorative, but what I mean by that is there's a strain of America that dates back to John Birch Society and before, and kind of looms its ugly head in many other forms, and we're seeing it now. But they'll be on here perhaps the next week to talk about what that means as well. But let's talk about this. I mean, is what we're seeing now from President Barack Obama, are we seeing the death of serious health care reform in Congress?
I think, Mark, we need to talk about the significant progress that we've made under President Obama already. Last year, under George Bush, we were nowhere in health care. He had vetoed twice the Children's Health Insurance Program, and there was no talk of any kind of other expansion. Already, in these 6-7 months that President Obama has been president, we've already expanded health care to 4 million children with the new CHIP bill, funded by an increase in cigarette tax, which has reduced teen smoking. We passed a stimulus package that includes billions of dollars for Medicaid expansion and giving millions of people access to health care, as well as health IT, health and health technology, and other ways to make health care work better. And third, he signed into law another law opposed by George Bush that will allow the FDA to regulate tobacco products and substantially reduce smoking, save lives, and reduce health care costs. We've already made a lot of progress in this country just in the last few months. And right now, I think we need to look at where we are in this whole debate. There are a lot of tremendous health care reform and expansion proposals which are getting broad consensus support. Expanding Medicaid, creating an exchange to reduce health care premiums, increasing more money into health technology, prevention funding to keep reducing health care cost drivers like smoking and obesity, et cetera, and many other proposals, subsidies for people to afford health care, many other proposals are becoming consensus proposals. And what we heard about today, the last couple of days, is discussion about the public option as one way to make healthcare more affordable. It is not off the table. It is something which many Democrats particularly are pushing. And we got a couple months more to discuss all this. But what I want to emphasize here is that whatever finally passed, we don't have the final form, there are many parts of this proposal which will benefit millions of Americans, which are becoming consensus. And I don't want to lose track of that. The public option is an important. We support it at our initiative, and we're going to fight for it. But without it, even without it, there is a lot in this legislation requiring all employers to do their fair share, expanding Medicaid. There are 11 million lower-income Americans who have no access to health care now, who will get it under this proposal, under something which is becoming consensus, expanding Medicaid coverage. So there's a lot of good, very good healthcare expansion that's going to happen, whether there's a public option or not, and we want that public option in there.
Mark, if I may comment.
Can we make sure the mic is up?
Am I on?
Yeah.
Sorry. It won't surprise you. I think Mr. DeMarco will make an excellent politician. But as a healthcare provider, my greatest concern is that we enact reform that's based on actual evidence of what works and what doesn't work. And so we see that this country, our healthcare costs are rising out of control. It's unsustainable. Our health outcomes are deteriorating. It is harder for practitioners to deliver quality care. And so we were really looking in this debate to have a debate about what would address the fundamental problems that we have in this country when it comes to health care. And we don't see any of these reform measures that are being considered as addressing these fundamental problems. You know, prevention is all very well and good. It actually adds cost. It doesn't save cost. The IT measures are not going to actually create dramatic savings with the public option. Even if 50% of the population enrolls in a public option, we're only going to see about 1/7 of the savings that we could save if we actually went to a national single-payer health system, which would be very simple. It would give everybody access to health care, the same standard of health care, choice of doctor, choice of treatment. And this is what we need to do. This is the discussion we need to be having, is about not how do we continue to patch together what we've been doing, which hasn't been working, but how do we actually take this opportunity to create a system that provides health care so we can be on par with the other industrialized nations?
Brad Herring.
So I guess first off, I mean, I really commend your enthusiasm and desire and support for a single-payer option or single-payer approach, but it just doesn't seem like that's what's under consideration among members of Congress. I mean, it seems like there's probably, I don't know, roughly about 80 or so representatives in the House that are supportive of it. And so as a result, the consensus about what people are talking about is kind of along the lines of what Vinny talked about. I mean, there is support for some general principles, Medicaid expansion, a health insurance exchange, lower income subsidies. I mean, people have kind of talked about maybe there's, or the Obama administration has talked about maybe there's about consensus on about 80% of the things, but it's the remaining 20% that are going to be a big challenge to get us home. And I mean, Mark, you kind of referenced the public option and the Obama's administration kind of stepping back from that. It seems like that's a calculated move to try and move to the center to gain more support from these so-called blue dog Democrats, perhaps some moderate Republicans, and hope that that added support outweighs the support they'll lose from the really liberal Democrats.
I wonder if, in this argument that's going to take place over the next several months, and it's going to be pretty vicious, I have a feeling, coming up, the battles between the House and the Senate, between the various positions. I mean, there are a lot of people who are for single payer in Congress who have now staked out their battleground for a public option, mm-hmm. that's where they're drawing the line in Congress, saying we're not going to back away from the public option. And I wonder if what would be acceptable at the end of all this? To those of you who, from very different perspectives in many ways, all want to see comprehensive health care reform, I mean, what is acceptable at the end of this debate for America and for you? Now, Vinny, you can start with Vinny if you like. Look like you're about to say something, which is fine. Then we'll go to Margaret. But I ask you this because I've known you for a long time on the airwaves together for many years, at least 10 years, in your battle around health care. And, I mean, you started off, if I remember, in the very beginning, organizing a statewide effort to create almost a single payer in the state of Maryland. And then you kind of, at least my assumption is, it was like a realpolitik moment. Or let's get something moving here since we can't do that. So I'm curious what you think is acceptable as reform at the end of this.
Well, we at the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative over the last few years took a close look at in Maryland what we can do to achieve quality, affordable health care for all Marylanders. And one of the things that became clear very quickly to us, and this has been substantiated by polling and discussions all around the country, is that the vast majority of Marylanders, and I think Americans, who have health insurance like the health insurance plans they have and don't want to be forced off them. Now, they support health care for all, and they want to make it happen. They understand it's good for everyone if everyone has quality, affordable health care. But it is a non-starter for the vast majority of Marylanders and Americans to say, take them off their plans and put them on one plan for everyone. That's just not going to work. So to come up with something that does work.
It's not going to work. Why?
Because the average Marylander, the average American would oppose it. It's simply We did many polls, and the latest poll that we did in Maryland was we compared our plan, which Brad helped put together, which achieves quality, affordable health care, building on what we have now, and we compare that to single payer. And it was 64% for our plan and 18% for single payer. And poll after poll in Maryland and around the country shows that the vast majority of people who have private health insurance like the plans they have and don't want to be removed from it.
So, but at the end of the day, as people, I hate that expression, I just used it, but when healthcare reform winds its way through Congress, right, what ends up being acceptable and not acceptable for
Well, you? President Obama laid it out very well. What he's going to sign, what he's willing to sign, includes several principles which we fully support. One, quality health care has to be affordable for everyone. And that means different things to different people in different income brackets and different situations. If you're below certain income level, and it's different discussions of where that is, you can't purchase health care on the private market. You're just impossible. That's why we need to expand Medicaid. We want that to go up to 200% of poverty in Maryland. They're talking about maybe 130%, which for a family of four is roughly $26,000, $27,000 a year. Below those income levels, there should be Medicaid, and that's one principle. Second principle, above that, people should have subsidies so they could afford health care, and we need to create, as Brad mentioned, an exchange, or we call it a pool, so that insurance companies can't gouge people, that there's an entity there negotiating for everyone. If you're a big company right now, like Safeway or Giant, and you're negotiating insurance for your company, the amount of the overhead that's not going to healthcare and your premiums about 8 or 9%. If you're a small company, it's like 20 or 30% or an individual up to 45%. If we put these pools together, like we're talking about in Maryland, President Obama's talking about, all the overhead will be down to 8 or 9%. It will be a lot of savings. And also the insurance companies under these proposals will be prohibited from denying people because they have pre-existing conditions or in other ways not treating them as they should. And we'll have a lot of insurance reform and we're going to reduce the amount of overhead going to insurance premiums. That's a second principle. Third principle is that everybody needs to do their fair share. As you know so well, this has been a central principle of everything we've done over the years. Everybody who can now afford health care needs to chip in, including individuals and companies. You're going to hear a lot about companies like Park Moving and Storage in Harford County. This gentleman there, Mark Derbyshire, has been in the news a lot because he provides full health care to his employees. Part of his premium goes to pay for the hospitalization of the uninsured, including some who work for his competitors who don't want to provide health care. That's not fair. All employers, all individuals who can afford to do so need to chip in. So those are the principles we're talking about.
And as a small employer myself,
yes,
I know how difficult it is to supply health care insurance.
Yes. Yes.
But you got to do it.
You got to do it. But there are those who don't, and they're ripping you off.
So, Margaret Flowers, I mean, what I want to ask you is this. Hearing what Vinnie DeMarco just said, and I know the battle that you and many others are fighting for a single-payer health care system in this country,
right.
And pushed it. And I'll just lay this out, and you can respond to it any way you like. If the political reality in America is, for a myriad of reasons, that there are not the votes there in the United States Congress to make it happen, that even if the majority of people in America by some polls want to see it, that a majority of people who are elected to the U.S. Congress, from Blue Dog Democrats to Republicans to others, are not interested in it and will not push it. And the healthcare industry has a huge corporate power and lobbying power in Washington, D.C. So what is acceptable or not acceptable to you at the end of this debate?
Well, the way that we view this is that there's political feasibility, which is what you're talking about,
right,
which is how many votes that you have. And then there's the practical feasibility. And the practical feasibility is whether reform is actually going to be successful in meeting the goals that you've set forth or not. And so when we look at what's being offered at this point, we don't see that it is going to be practically feasible. We don't see that it's going to control health care costs. We see that actually we're going to be throwing more cost in to things such as the exchanges, which have been tried in California and in Massachusetts and have not been successful in helping to control costs or helping people to get more insurance. So we may go through this whole huge battle that we're getting ready to go through, and at the end of the day, when the plan is passed, we're going to be in the same boat, really, and in a couple of years, we'll be right back here. Things are not over in terms of going towards a national health program. As Dr. Herring said, we have about 86 co-sponsors for HR 676. But in my position as congressional fellow, I've spent the summer meeting with legislators in Congress from all different spectra, all different sides of the aisle and viewpoints. Many of them understand that public financing of health care is the only way that we can control health care costs and cover everybody. They're not able to come out publicly and say that because their constituents aren't there yet. But some of them have even said to us that if it came down and looked like a single payer bill was going to be close to getting the votes, that they would vote for it, knowing that they would not be reelected if they did.
So it's interesting. It's the last time we had a discussion with the same guests in the studio, most of the same guests. We also had an electrical thunderstorm. I don't know if this is
It is quite a coincidence, Mark.
God is speaking to us right now.
So this is
you bring it out in disguise. Well, can I just Margaret said something very interesting, which she recognizes that it's the constituents who don't want single payer because they like the health insurance they have. And that's a fundamental reason why we need to do health care the way we're doing it. And I want to emphasize this. We here in Maryland have made some substantial progress. Since July 1, 2008, we went from 44th in the country in health care to 21st. And since then, 45,000 people who didn't have health care have health care under the leadership of Governor Martin O'Malley. And that law has been very successful, helped a lot of people. Now, Margaret testified against that law. It's one thing to be for single payer, and I agree with Brad. I commend Margaret for her work for that. But don't oppose legislation which is going to help people who really need it now. And that's what we're saying. We're asking our single payer friends, that's your ultimate goal? That's great. But while you're now, help us achieve what can be achieved, what can help people who really need it.
I just...
Margaret Flowers.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to that. For one thing, I don't support expansion of Medicaid as a solution. When I testified against the Medicaid expansion, it was really to educate the legislators about the fact that this approach has been tried in state after state and has not ever succeeded in solving the problems that they have. These types of reforms of subsidizing private insurance, mandating private insurance, expanding Medicaid have been tried over and over in this country, and not one time have we seen sustained improvement in that direction. I also wanted to correct Mr. DeMarco in that when I said that the constituents didn't support a single payer, it wasn't that because they love their health insurance. Actually, these are often people from states in the South that are very poor, where a very high portion of the population does not have health insurance. But unfortunately, they're misinformed because of the media that they listen to in those markets, telling them that single payer is socialized medicine and that they don't want the government between them and their doctor. And those are the populations who continue to need to be educated, and we're working to reach out to them.
Brad?
So I guess I'd like to follow up on one of the things Margaret said about California, the experience in California and Massachusetts not being that successful. And I guess I would disagree with that. I think what Massachusetts has done has actually been a pretty strong success. And I think the example of California's attempt to use insurance exchanges wasn't large enough. It wasn't subsidized. So I really wouldn't look to that as a good example of implementation. But my interest, my area of interest as far as my research goes, would really try and emphasize improving the functioning of private health insurance markets now. I mean, they're currently not ideal for sure. There's discrimination in the individual market. Individual market premiums are expensive. The small group market doesn't function that well. And so I really do think that there are a number of things that could be done to reform the health insurance market, namely this notion of an insurance exchange, really try and improve the marketplace, increase the amount of competition among private health insurers, increase choice among people enrolling in those plans, couple that with what's called community rating and guaranteed issue so that higher risk people can't be discriminated against. And then finally, kind of the third leg of the stool is to have an individual mandate coupled with low income subsidies to try and counter adverse selection that may occur when you implement these community rating guaranteed issue laws.
And Brad is absolutely right. The Massachusetts worked well. They went from 13% uninsured to 3%. That's hundreds of thousands of people who have health care now who wouldn't have had it without the new Massachusetts plan.
And I mean, and they are certainly struggling with trying to fund this into the future, right? So it's not perfect, but it definitely, I think, can be viewed as a big success. And I think many of the architects there had this approach. I mean, maybe this is kind of what they've come up with after the fact, but I think their approach now is to say, well, look, our initial attempt really was just to get everybody covered, get everybody in the pool. Once we've succeeded with that, let's then try and work on payment reform to try and lower the growth in spending. And so the discussions in Massachusetts are beginning about, you know, how to transform us away from fee-for-service reimbursement.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about Massachusetts, I do work closely with people who are in Massachusetts. And so they have not been able to make health insurance affordable there. People who live in Massachusetts who are close to the line beyond which they would receive a subsidy are intentionally keeping their incomes below the subsidy line because if they go above it, they will not be able to afford insurance. Because they've added co-pays and raised those co-pays, people in Massachusetts are not getting the care that they need, because they can't afford, once they've paid for the premium, to pay the out-of-pocket costs. So if you look at the numbers of people who saw cost as a barrier prior to the time that the reform was enacted, and then you look at it after the reform was enacted, we actually see that there was a slight decrease, which you often see when a new reform is instituted. But within a few years, the number of people saying that finances was a barrier to care for them was back higher than it was pre-reform. In addition, Boston Medical Center is suing the state for $180 million because they were cut funds under the belief that there would be less uncompensated care. That was not the reality, and so now they're having to sue the state for that money for compensated care, uncompensated care. The state is dumping about 30,000 people off the plans to make it sustainable for them. You know, we don't see this again. It gets very complicated when you try to go through these different patchwork solutions instead of actually stepping back, looking what's been done in other nations, what's been successful, and what we have here. Medicare is very successful.
Let me ask this question. I want to get you to join us who are listening to this right now at 410-319-8888. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Your thoughts about where our healthcare debate is. Are you happy with your coverage? What would you like to see in its place? If you do want to see something in its place, what do you think about where the healthcare debate, reform debate is taking the state and this country now? At 410-319-8888, you just heard Dr. Margaret Flowers, who is the Congressional Fellow for the Physicians for a National Health Program. Vinnie DeMarco, who's Executive Director of Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, and Brad Herring, Assistant Professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health, 410-319-8888.
You know, Mark,
but let me just ask, I've got to take a little shift here for a minute. I want to ask this question. Let's say this thing moves ahead and some form of health care reform passes in September or October. Most likely October.
I think that's optimistic.
November.
But one of the things that many people have written about is that what it's not going to do is deal with price controls for drug companies. It's not going to deal with the price controls or the kinds of insurance that health insurance companies can give. That it may cover one hell of a lot more people than we have covered today in America, but it will do nothing to control the exploding health care costs. And it seems to me that, with all due respect to the people in the healthcare industry who are not at this table today, but I'd say it when they're at this table next, is that they will walk away feeling like we've done it. We have given them a kind of sort of healthcare reform, but we sure have protected all of our profits and all of our side, and we're going to move ahead. And we still have not dealt with the major questions that could bankrupt this country and bankrupt healthcare in the years to come.
Well, first of all, the House Energy and Commerce bill does include negotiating with the drug companies to reduce prescription drug costs for Medicare, which I think should be in legislation. We're very supportive of that. We want that to happen. And there are ways that the federal proposals and our proposal here in Maryland would reduce the costs of health insurance and reduce health insurance profits through these exchanges and through what we're calling a pool. These are strong measures which will take a lot of the profit out of health insurance premiums, and I think that's something we need to do. So, but I think there's more that can be done. I think the plan that we put together here in Maryland does a lot more to make health care affordable than what they're thinking about in Congress, and I would urge them to take a look at it. But there are substantial measures in the health reform bills that are in Congress right now that will address what you're talking about. But I just got to say something about what Margaret said. What happened in Massachusetts has provided health care for hundreds of thousands of people who didn't have it before. No plan is perfect. And here in Maryland, the bill that Margaret opposed provided health care to 45,000 people. And Margaret should say that didn't work to people like Angela Newman, who are desperate for health care. And because this bill was enacted, now have it. So what I'm saying is, make your goal single payer, make your goal whatever it is, but don't oppose measures which help people who are desperate for health care now.
I will let Margaret return the volley there when we come back from this break. And also I want to promise to Pam and her car and Joanne in Ellicott City and Dan in Charles Village that when Margaret makes her response to Vinnie DeMarco. When we come back, we're going to come right to the phones and get your thoughts in the air. So stay with us here at 410-319-8888 on the Mark Steiner Show. And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorder Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advanced stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. We'll be right back to debate healthcare here on the Mark Steiner Show. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking about healthcare reform here on the Mark Steiner Show today. First, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We are joined in studio by Vinnie DeMarco, who you just heard, Executive Director of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. Dr. Margaret Flowers is Congressional Fellow for Physicians for National Healthcare Program, and Dr. Brad Herring is Assistant Professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And it's steinershow@gmail.com and 410-319-8888. You are the listeners who make this station go and make this show interesting, along with our guests. So join us here at 410-319-8888. Margaret Flowers said, let's just go to the callers. We'll do that. And Pam, Joanne, Dan, in that order. Pam, in your car, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Pam.
I have two comments. My first comment is that although I'm not of the age of being on Medicare as of yet, I do have, you know, somewhat dealings, a lot of extensive dealings, because I have older relatives mm-hmm. that are on Medicare. And I must say that I do like the way Medicare works. I think that Medicare is more working with sick people, and they don't question so much everything that goes on as far as who's responsible for something, you know, trying to get out of paying a bill, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as far as adding more people onto Medicare, I think, in my opinion, I don't know, although I am a proponent of single payer, but I don't see how that's going to wash right now. We have to deal with what we have, and so we have to make the best of that. And I think that having people on Medicare may help somewhat in some way. Now, my other comment is I get my health insurance from my employer, and I believe you asked if people were happy with what they have.
That's one of the questions I asked, yes.
And I think that, I don't know if it's a solution, but it's a thought, that instead of having your employer only able to negotiate with one insurer,
right.
I think that they should be able to negotiate with all of them. It shouldn't be dependent on the size of a company on what you can afford as an employer. I think you should be able to negotiate prices with all the insurers. And I think that may be a way to have some type of competition. Do I like what I have? Not really.
Uh-huh.
But I would, you know, it's fine. It's okay. But I prefer to, maybe I don't like what I have. Maybe I like Blue Cross Blue Shield. But I have to go with what my company has. So I guess competition between the insurance companies with employers is something that may be a solution, and I'll get off the phone and listen to your comments.
Thank you so much, Pam. Brad Herring, why don't you go first on this round?
Sure. So I think many people would argue that large employers have relatively successfully offered health insurance coverage to their workers. I mean, certainly it's a lot more expensive than people would wish, but everyone's offered health insurance coverage. Virtually everyone's offered health insurance coverage when they work at a large firm, and they're offered, generally offered, more than one plan. And so, you know, some workers may have preferences for managed care plans. Some workers may have preferences for preferred provider organizations with an annual deductible. And so there's some sense of meeting people's preferences for coverage. And conversely, in the small group market, many small firms don't offer health insurance coverage, but for those that do, generally it's just one plan that's offered. And so the appeal of an exchange is twofold, and I think Pam kind of hit on both of them. One is that by pooling a bunch of small firms together, it might act more like a large firm, get better discounts from the private health insurers, but then also perhaps allow the workers in small firms to have more of a choice among the different health insurance options offered through an exchange, rather than essentially having to enroll in the one plan the small employer chooses for them.
This is Margaret. I just wanted to comment that so many people have been told that what they really need is a choice of a health insurance plan. And most people can't figure out, looking at the health insurance plans, what plan would be appropriate for them, nor can people actually anticipate what their health needs are going to be, because it can change very quickly if you are, you know, struck with a serious illness or with an accident. The plan that meets our needs is the plan, or the plan that we need is the one that actually covers our health care needs as we need them. And that's what a comprehensive national single payer plan would do. When you have health problems, it would pay for them. The reason it would do that is because what private insurance does now, the investor-owned private insurance corporations, are financial institutions who are beholden to their stockholders. And so they make their decisions not based on what's best for the health of the patient, but what's best for their investors' portfolios. And that's why we as physicians struggle so much in practice, because we will see a patient, decide on a treatment with that patient, and then the health insurance company will deny, may deny that treatment for that patient, not based on what's best for the patient, but based on what they can get away with not paying for. And so we don't see a value to financing our health care through private insurance companies. They don't add anything. They actually detract from the quality of our health in this country.
Let me go back to the phones and get our listeners to come back here. And I have some other questions as well for our guests as we look at health care reform here and where it is going and what we can expect. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Joanne in Ellicott City, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Joanne. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm in health care, and I just had a couple of comments. Number one, I agree with Dr. Flowers about the single-payer system, but this is my take on it. I think that health insurance is, I don't know that that's really going to solve the issue of all the uninsured people in America. I think what the government needs to think about is doing demographic studies and plopping down some public health centers demographically throughout the United States and staffing them with physicians that they pay a salary to. The problem with, I think, healthcare in America now is that people don't have access, meaning, i.e., preventative care, which is the majority of what a lot of people need, and, of course, hypertension, diabetes. So if they were able to go to a health center where they're familiar with the physicians and get that care, and then the government provide a health hospital health insurance plan, i.e. like Medicare B or something like that, where if they needed additional workups or testing, that they could they would have the health insurance available and be able to go to the hospital or be admitted to the hospital and have coverage under that plan. I think the immediate is what people need, and a lot of the emergency room visits in the United States of America are really uncalled for. A lot of the things that they treat in the ER can be treated in a health center if they were to put them in the proper areas that really have the least amount of healthcare providers. And then second of all, no one with the healthcare reform is addressing tort reform, which is part of the problem. And then the health insurance companies also don't provide affordable insurance to people who don't have the means to obtain health insurance. That's one of the problems. And I'm a physician, and I have health insurance, thankfully, through my company, but I have a $2,400 deductible. And that's part of the problem also with health plans today, is that you have to put out money before they'll even start to cover any preventative care for you. So that's prescription coverage. Anything that's out of pocket, right, you're going to have to pay before you get covered. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think there's a number of problems with health care right now, and I think the system is definitely in need of repair. I'm not sure that quote-unquote health insurance I think that gives people a sense of security. What they need is access to care. And if the care were in an area where they were able to get to the area and get the care that they needed with a person that they felt comfortable with providing that care, I think that would probably solve a lot of the problems. And then secondly...
Oh, okay. Finish up to me. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just to finish, one of the programs that funded a lot of these healthcare clinics back in the 1980s was the healthcare public health service. And they basically paid for medical school education, and then doctors reimbursed the government with 4 years of service if they received the scholarship for 4 years, and then they would go out and work in these centers and provide care. And that program was actually cut by Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. I'm sure your Dr. Flowers is familiar with that program. And I think perhaps maybe that would be one solution to getting back to providing preventative care in a lot of areas and access to health care, is if they were to implement some government programs, which would probably be cheaper than providing people with quote-unquote health care insurance. Well, so if you could pass that to your panel and see what yes. they think about those ideas.
I was going to hear Vinnie DeMarco. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think the caller made some great points, and I think she will find a lot that she will like both in our Maryland Health Care for All plan, which is on our website, healthcareforall.com, and all the federal plans that are being considered in Congress. We make prevention and keeping people healthy a central goal of our plan, and I think same at the federal level. And some of the specific things she talked about, which is reducing the loans that doctors coming out of law school, medical school have if they go to areas in need. We have that in our plan. We put money into community health centers, as do the federal plans. And we agree that prevention is very important. Reducing obesity, smoking, keeping people healthy, and encouraging people to use treatments and drugs and procedures that are evidence-based and work. These are all methods that will do what the caller's trying to accomplish, and those are key parts of our plan and the federal plan.
But we have destroyed in this country pretty much funding for public health system in America, and we've also gotten rid of all the municipal hospitals around the country. We used to have one here in Baltimore that's now part of Hopkins, a city hospital. And, I mean, and those were the public facilities that people would go to. They're gone. I mean, the public option that we're talking about here really is if you have Medicare, if you're a veteran, in lesser forms if you're on Medicaid, because they don't cover as much as Medicare does, don't do as well as Medicare. But, I mean, those two, especially Medicare and the veterans benefits, are public options that work. They provide health care. I haven't seen any veteran yet stand up and go, take away my veterans benefits, I don't want them.
Well, that's the beauty of having a system, and that's what sets us apart from other industrialized nations, is that we don't have an actual system at the state level or at the national level where we can actually look at what our health needs are and allocate our resources based on the areas that need those. What we have here instead is, because of the profit-driven side of our health industry, if one hospital in an area receives a certain or purchases a certain technology which they can make a profit off of, the hospital down the street then feels that they need to do the same thing to compete with that hospital. That's not the right kind of competition that we need. But if we create a health system, many of the ideas that this doctor raised, we can do in terms of creating regional health centers and incentives to bring physicians into those areas.
Do you want to add to this moment before we go back to the phones?
One thing piqued my interest that you said, this notion of competition between private hospitals. I mean, under a single payer system, that wouldn't go away, would it? I mean, and I guess maybe it'd be helpful to the listeners to understand the distinction between a single payer versus what many people refer to as socialized medicine, like the system of the VA or the UK, England, right. So single payer would be analogous to Medicare or the Canadian government, in which the government acts as the single payer, the insurer, while hospitals and physicians are private and they're reimbursed from that insurer. Whereas in the UK and the VA, the hospitals are essentially owned by the government, and
the doctors are employees.
Doctors are employees.
So provisions of the National Health Care Act here in the United States is that hospitals would receive a global operating budget. That makes it easier for them to know, you know, what budget they have to work with, and not to have so many billing staff to fight with the insurance companies. The other thing is a rational allocation of capital resources. So instead of hospitals being able to purchase technology to compete with the hospital down the street, you would look at it more on a regional basis of what the need is. And so you would say, okay, we have, you know, we have enough of this certain technology to serve this population, but this population over on this other side doesn't have that.
I don't want to digress into this right now too deeply, what you just said, but is part of the problem with that is that in America, you have hospitals either owned by private corporations or hospitals that are owned by huge nonprofits like Johns Hopkins, that would be very hard to kind of say, you can't buy this piece of equipment. Maybe that might be a smart idea in some ways economically, but very difficult to get that kind of program installed, especially given how the hospital care system works in America. How do you do that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are very squeamish about the government deciding just how much should be spent on healthcare in terms of this process of allocating budgets to hospitals.
Let me ask you about the three of you a very quick political question, and go right back to the phones because I do want to get these other callers in. When President Barack Obama and the administration started backing away from the public option, which they seem to be doing, things can change, but right now they seem to be backing away from it. Maybe the congressional Democrats in the House will give them some more backbone to push ahead. We'll see, but they seem to be backing away from it. Bob Herbert, the New York Times columnist, said that his line was, there will be no effective alternative for consumers in the market for health coverage, which means no competitive measure, pressure for private insurers to rein in premiums and other charges. Forget about, if we don't have a public option. Forget about the nonprofit cooperatives. That's like sending peewee footballers up against the Super Bowl champs, which I thought was a great line. Right. But what is going on here? Why is this happening? Why is the public option being pushed off the table? And what's going to happen if that option does not remain on the table?
Well, let me emphasize something here. What Mr. Herbert is not recognizing, and what I think the public needs to understand, is that there are substantial measures in the federal proposals that President Obama is pushing that are becoming almost consensus that will reduce insurance premiums through these exchanges, that will put substantial limits on what the insurance companies can do that are now hurting people, like denying people of pre-existing conditions. And there are other measures in these proposals which will achieve these goals. Now, I want the public option to be in there, and our organization supports it. We want it to stay. But I want everybody to understand that President Obama has taken us a long way so that these other proposals, which a year ago were impossible, like the exchanges, like the employer contributions, are now consensus, and we're looking to push the envelope with the public option, which is good. So that's very, very important. So it's not a matter of the plan being not working at all if there's no public option. The public option is good. We need to fight for it. But there are substantial measures in the proposal that will work to reduce premiums.
Margaret, then Brad, then to the phones is Suzanne in Baltimore.
Oh, thanks. Well, our organization, Physicians for National Health Program, is part of a broader coalition of organizations called the Leadership Conference for Guaranteed Healthcare, because we believe that healthcare is a human right, and we know that the countries who've adopted a human rights approach, which is universality, equity, and accountability, have better health outcomes and spend less money. We don't see the current reform the solutions to the fundamental problems that we have with healthcare in this country, and we're going to continue working towards what we see as the only solution, which will be universal and affordable, which the current plan being considered in Congress is, they've admitted, not universal and also will not control health care costs. But this is a human rights issue. It's got to be treated as a civil rights issue. If you really want to get true health care reform in this country, then you need to educate yourself and speak out and put pressure on Congress to do the right thing.
Brad, you want to add to this before we go back to the phone?
Maybe just make a couple of comments about how, I mean, it seems there's actually a bit of a range in terms of public options people are considering. I think kind of at the far left of the spectrum would have a public option that essentially pays Medicare rates or Medicare plus 5% or 10% higher. And that virtually, I mean, that essentially has no support among Republicans. And I'd say a lot of these blue dog moderate Democrats are pretty squeamish about it. And so in the Senate, Senator Conrad was kind of, I guess, given this task, we'll try and come up with something that seems to satisfy both parties, something that some Republicans could live with, and something that still might be like a nonprofit public plan. And so this is where this notion of co-ops have come in, right? So rather than have it be a government entity, government would provide some seed money so that a nonprofit co-op could essentially be constructed and serve as a competitor to these private plans. But I mean, I loved Bob Herbert's quote,
that's a great quote.
In the Times this morning about Pee Wee League. Because our experience with co-ops is okay. You know, you've got like some dairy farmers or rural electricity, and health insurance is much, much more complex in terms of negotiating payment rates with providers, coming up with a network of providers, determining what the premiums have to be, setting aside money in reserves, and just to really think about doing that and competing with these pre-existing private plans. They could pull it off.
It seemed to me, given the sophistication of the White House, it seemed to me to be a very weird thing to have kind of backed away into a cooperative. Just, it was a very strange kind of political happenstance. But let me go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Suzanne in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Suzanne. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for hosting this discussion. It's so important to have right now. I just wanted to call and comment that I'm a recent graduate of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and a fortunate beneficiary of the recent Maryland law, which allows young adults to stay on their parents' plan up to age 25. So I really like the care that my parents and I pay for, and I want to keep it. I like the system. And I also do a lot in my community in trying to help people who are looking for free and low-cost health care options. And the Medicaid expansion that Mr. DeMarco mentioned has made a world of difference, that now we have something we can offer people. Before, like, nobody qualified for Medicaid, and especially adults. The program for children is very generous, but for adults, we really went a long way, and it's made a huge difference, especially with the economic downturn. And I was really surprised to hear Dr. Flowers state that prevention costs more when the health benefits for prevention are invaluable, and has made such a difference for the families that I've been working with, that they can take care of their diabetes and asthma. And I really agree that we've got to do something now, and I think that working with the system that we have, as Professor Herring and Mr. DeMarco talked about, is really something that I would support. And I'm just interested in, I've also done, some schoolwork on the other programs in other countries, and I agree that they've got some great systems. Maybe that's something that we can get to eventually. I agree that I don't think it's politically feasible right now, and it's practically feasible. We need this reform right now, and I think Medicaid expansion and the other reforms that are in the proposal are really strong. So just from my experience in the community and from my background, I wanted to say thank you for having this, and those are my thoughts.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. So why don't you defend that position you made before and let us respond?
Well, I mean, I understand Mr. DeMarco's efforts to try to expand health care to people, and I applaud him for doing that. The way that we do our health care reform work is that we're looking at actually creating a solution which is going to be long-lasting and improve the quality of health in a sustainable fashion. And so, as I've said before, if you look at states who have implemented programs where they mandated insurance or expanded Medicaid or provided subsidies, none of these states have been able to sustain those programs so that they provide health care to every person. And that's our goal, is to make it so that we control health care costs and provide health care to every person who needs it. And I don't want to be misunderstood that I don't support prevention, because that's not what I said. I support prevention 100%. As a pediatrician, that's what we're all about. We start with children, the majority of which are very healthy, and we would like to keep them that way for the remainder of their lives. But you cannot talk about prevention as a cost control measure, because studies show that prevention, while it is of value and it creates a healthier society, does not contain health care costs. So we can't mention that. That's included in the plan, as is expansion of IT. IT is, technology in terms of electronic medical records is going to improve communication. It's not going to significantly control our health care costs.
We have just a few minutes left. Vinny or Brad, who wants to pick up on one of these thoughts?
Just, like Brad, I commend Dr. Flowers and her group for putting these ideas out there. But what we ask of them is to not make the perfect the enemy of the good, and to not oppose and stand in the way of measures which will help people who desperately need that help right now. And that's what we're trying to do. And I think we've put together a plan which is the best that Maryland can do. And I think the federal plan that President Obama is proposing is what can be done at the national level now, and but we need to make that happen.
This is a question, maybe a very quick answer, because we have like only 90 seconds left. I mean, if what the indications are now that people on the progressive end of the spectrum and others in America are backing away from Obama's plan, that this whole thing could be in trouble, and so could he, if many of the people who put him into office are not happy with what they're seeing him do.
I think the people who are concerned will be less concerned if they see the whole plan, if they understand there is a lot in addition to the public option which will help millions of Americans. And we're still going to fight for that public option, but what Americans need to understand, especially those who really like President Obama, that what he's proposing overall will help people, and that 80% that we have consensus on is really terrific.
I would just say I think the progressives on the left will have to come to a decision of whether they'll support what moves a little bit towards the middle as being better than the status quo, if they're willing to support that rather than their preferred option.
15 seconds, Margaret.
Well, we struggled as a Physicians for National Health program on how we would approach the reform, and we felt like it was important that we stick to what is evidence-based and what is honest. And we don't see in this reform measures that are going to be universal or control our health care costs, and so we're going to keep pushing for that.
Well, we'll continue our push and look at health care reform. We're going to hopefully put together a forum with our congressional delegation soon here on campus to continue this conversation until it is redone in Congress, and we won't stop then. Vinnie DeMarco, Dr. Margaret Flowers, and Brad Herring, thank you all three for giving your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this very brief break. And we are joined by Dr. Andres Alonso, CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools, as we talk about the future of our schools this coming school year. Stay with us.